Good morning. Let's begin. This is a public hearing concerning objections to conditions on recertified equipment. This is the fourth in a series of four public hearings conducted by the Secretary of State. For the record, my name is Bill Hobbs, Deputy Secretary of State, conducting the hearing on behalf of Secretary of State Mike Kaufman. The date is March 7th, 2008. The time is 10:06 a.m., and we're meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. To my immediate left is Stephanie Sigelski, Legal Specialist with the Elections Division of the Secretary of State. To my immediate right is John Gardner, who is the head of the Secretary of State's Voting System Certification Program. And to his right, Michael Chadwell, also with the testing program. And we do have sign-up sheets, and we have a few people signed up to testify. Just by way of background, after the decisions of the Secretary of State on December 17th, we did hold our office held meetings with each of the vendors and the affected clerks to go over the overview binders, which is where the conditions appear. We had also, our office had made made it known that that conditions could be addressed, or issues with conditions could be addressed in a couple of different ways, either through an informal process under Section 1-5-621, subsection 7, I think it is, or under the formal reconsideration process under subsection 6 of that section if a condition is perceived to amount to a decertification. And we did receive a number of submissions of conditions that clerks had issues with. But then with the passage of House Bill 1155, that provided a third means of dealing with the December 17th decisions. And it's the intent of the Secretary of State through this process and through this hearing to use 1155 to address as much as possible issues with conditions, and preferably within the 30 days that House Bill 1155 provides for it. It simply says that the clerks need to know within 30 days of the passage of the bill basically what the situation is with their equipment. So our hope is that that by the 30th day, which is March 12th from the time the governor signed the bill, that we'll be able to address most of the conditions that and hopefully all of the conditions that have been brought up as having issues. But as indicated in the public notice of this hearing, that any decisions made by March 12th do not necessarily foreclose continuing to discuss the conditions that are attached to the recertified equipment. I want to repeat something I've said in other hearings, that that the conditions do not apply to grandfathered equipment. I don't know whether that actually is relevant to ES&S or not, but any equipment purchased or acquired before May 28, 2004 is not subject to the conditions attached to the recertification decisions. And I also know, just as a general matter, the testing board has been, from December 17th to date, has been working on various issues, some of which may relate to the conditions that are imposed on the ES&S equipment, but I don't know that. So one of the reasons for having testing board representatives here today is if they have additional information to report, I want to make sure that Mr. Gardner, if you'll bring that up or let us know. And likewise, to the extent that objections are made to conditions, there may be questions of the testing board that might relate to those objections, such as, why is the condition there and how does it relate to a deficiency and so forth. So, we can certainly have an exchange about those kinds of things. So with that, I think I will turn it over to however the clerks want to proceed, whoever would like to go first, or the vendor, or whatever, it's, I'll leave it up to you guys. Mr. Pearson.
Oh boy.
Is that here? Can't tell yet.
There we go.
Okay. Good morning.
Good. Thank you.
My name is Steve Pearson. I'm the Vice President of Certification for Election Systems and Software. And thanks for this opportunity to address these. The approach that we want to take today is kind of a twofold approach. I specifically would like to address the DRE condition, specifically condition number 8 on the Ivotronic, the device security accessibility condition that was published in the most recent project overview binder, A.4. And then both Josh Liss and Amy Storm from Jefferson and Mesa counties will then address each one of the other more operational conditions as it affects their county procedures. So that's the approach that we'd like to take today. We'd like it to be an interactive, open discussion if we can on these things. And then we will be submitting a combined formal submission prior to the deadline then on Monday, okay. if that's okay.
That's great. Thank okay. you.
I have a letter with some options that I would like to give to you now, and then we can go through these, and I think specifically as it pertains to the DRE solutions that we would like to put in front of you today.
Okay. Thank you.
Would you like me to give you time to read it until we get to the options, or would you like me just to read through it? It's fairly short.
Perhaps just go through it. I don't know if you want to read, I don't mind, or just highlight it, whatever you think would be most useful.
Okay. Give you a chance to browse through that first, and then I mean, ideally what we want to get to, there's two options that we have proposed as a result of the device security accessibility condition that I'd like to go through in detail with you today.
Okay. I think if you want to just then start walking us through the options.
Okay. But when this condition was first raised, and you know, we've been working quite some time to validate and understand better the results from the Everest report, as well as the Colorado State Testing Board's reports as it pertained to the introduction of a magnet into the Ivotronic PEB well. So we have not been able to replicate to date yet the tests that have been performed or at least reported under the Everest report, and we have talked with some of the makers of the Everest report, and they were really never able to fully compromise the system as it was allegedly reported in their report as well. So with that, and we will continue to research those items, but we have come up with two solutions that we want to put in front of you for consideration, and they can be viewed exclusively, or they could be viewed in combination as well. The first option, really, we wanted to look at the issue from a firmware standpoint. Can this concern be addressed and mitigated through the use of a firmware modification? The Ivotronic firmware modifications can be made to inhibit any detrimental terminal activation by a common pocket magnet or cloned PEB, or a PEB that is either not operating properly or has a dead internal battery. Our proposed operation in case one, which is illustrated here below, will be implemented only for a poll worker activated operation. Now we have our counties, there are two customers in Colorado, one operates in a poll worker, and the other currently operates in a voter-activated mode for the system. Only the cast and cancel, which case two, will be incorporated for the voter-activated mode of voting. So case one, terminal status, and it's important to understand what the terminal status is, because that is when a voter would have access to the machine. So the terminal would be in an open status for voting. So it would only be after the polls are opened and the terminal is available for a voter to have access to the system. So as we identify, open for voting and terminal is powered off or displaying the welcome screen. That would be a normal state for anybody that's approached being escorted to the system to activate by a poll worker for activation of the system for a voter. Okay, it would either be off in a powered down shutdown, or it would be displaying the welcome screen for that voter, depending on how recently the previous voting session had been taken place.
Because it times out? Or,
yeah, yeah, it just, yeah, to, it just shuts down, okay. You know, yeah, it goes into a shutdown mode. I'm sorry, yeah, like a sleep mode, basically. So we'll walk through each one of these bullets, and I think it's really important you understand the progress and the steps that, as we go through this. A pocket magnet or any...
Steve, so it doesn't actually power off, does it?
Yeah, the machine there's power to it, but it's in an idle state. It shuts down.
It shuts down as opposed to like a screensaver mode or something like that.
I can't answer that. I'm all kind of hesitant.
I don't know that it matters.
I'd have to.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm told it.
But I can get it. I can get a better answer for you on that.
No, it sounds like
if it's important. Yeah. So as a pocket magnet or any PEB is inserted into the well, the terminal will power up. And we have if on battery, but if there's power available to the unit. And then begin to communicate with the device in the PEB well. Okay, so the system now will activate and begin its communication process with the PEB or the magnet that has been inserted into the well. And there's a note, terminal may still perform firmware CRC prior to the PEB well communication. So there will be some activity that would be going on, you know, behind the scenes.
What's CRC?
It's a redundancy check. Yeah, is what it is. Circular redundancy check. For an incorrect device found in the PEB well, the error screen will display until the device is removed from the well, and that's the way the system currently operates today. When a correct poll worker PEB or a cloned poll worker PEB for the election is inserted into the well, what we would then do is display a password keyboard for the poll worker to enter a unique password that has been established and determined for this election in order to allow the system to proceed to display the ballot for the voter. Poll worker would then enter a password in order to proceed. Password proposed may be the last four digits of the election qualification code, we call the EQC code, which is unique for each election, or another password to be determined. And there's various methods for determining a unique, establishing a unique password for that election. So the correct password would be entered. Continuation into the ballot selection would be in a normal manner. So all we're doing is inserting a step now. It's another security step that only a poll worker that would have the unique password for this election would be able to enter. Okay, that would then present the vote, the ballot then for the voter, and the poll worker would leave at that point. If an incorrect password is entered, a screen on the terminal will require the PEB in the well to be removed, and then the system will power down or return to the welcome screen if it's on the AC power. That's the differentiation from up above. Any questions on so far on that?
So this is something that would be achieved by a firmware modification. Is that?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it's a very minor modification for both of these, case one and case two. This change to add this additional layer of security for a qualified password is about a 2 to 3 day effort on our side to make the change, test the change. So at that point, you know, then we would need to discuss what the next steps would be. But it's a minor change to the system.
John?
Thank you. Two questions. Maybe we'll do them individually. If in this modification a password is cloned maliciously, thereby they would have the EQC code, wouldn't that then give them the password that they would need to enter the system?
If you have somebody internal that has, I mean, you're going to have trusted people that have this information to support the system. So I guess if that password, just like any other passwords in the system, in any system, you know, gets out of control and gets, you know, in the hands of a voter, then that would basically it would allow them to go into their voting session is all it would really allow them to do at that point.
Okay. The next question would be, if you have a non-qualified supervisor PEB, the red band PEB, would you still be able to enter the calibration screen with this firmware change?
If it's a non-qualified PEB,
yes.
It would not allow the voting session or the terminal to go past that point. It would still require a valid PEB to be able to access the system.
Okay. So the change doesn't affect our testing outcome that we have demonstrated where a supervisor PEB, non-qualified, can enter the calibration screen.
We believe it does, but we could do further testing on that with you,
okay,
to ensure that that's resolved. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And then case two, the terminal status open for voting, and terminal is in active voting session. A pocket magnet or any PEB is inserted into the well. Terminal will communicate with the device in the PEB well. Incorrect device found in the PEB well, error screen will display until correct PEB is installed so that the cast cancel may be performed, same as the current operation. So for instance, if a voter were to walk away and the terminal is sitting there in a voting mode, and then today a poll worker would go up and do a cast and cancel based on the procedures and what your election code permits, the system would be enabled to do that only when a correct and a valid qualified PEB would be inserted. So it's an additional step. Well, that's actually the way it works today, isn't it? You have to have a supervisor PEB in that situation. So a correct poll worker PEB or cloned poll worker PEB for the election is in the well. The password keyboard will just be displayed again. So it's really dependent on having a secure password for the election worker to be able to allow the system to continue into any other state. The poll worker would then enter the password in order to proceed. The password proposed, again, it's the same as we suggested in the previous case. When the correct password is entered, the continuation into the normal cast cancel functionality would be permitted. So those are the beginning of the voting session, and then the scenario where there's a cast cancel, that's really where the introduction of an additional step would be. To enter a valid password. So if an incorrect password is entered, the system will not allow the exit without proper password entry. If the PEB is pulled while on a password screen, the terminal will be waiting for a PEB insertion. Can't power down the terminal until completion of the cast and cancel or voting session will be lost. those are the two scenarios where the addition of the a password control would be entered. The other option that we're offering is a hardware modification to the Colorado Ivotronics. The state's proposed solution to locking out the PEB well has been reviewed internally by ES&S, and the method proposed by the state has generated a few questions and logistical issues that we would need to get clarification on. Our first point of clarification is it the state's intent that the well be locked down during the voting sessions and must be unlocked prior to each ballot activation?
Take those one at a time, John.
I believe the answer is yes, if I'm understanding the question correctly.
Okay. Noted. Does the state envision having all of these lock devices uniquely keyed? And how many key variations would be required? Or how many key variations would be required?
Okay, good. I think, well, for those listening, you know, security models would kind of dictate that individually keyed would be ideal. A second level would be unique keys at the county level, so each county would have a different set of keys. But we have allowed other systems to go through with universally keyed locks and devices, and I think that would be okay. It'd probably be preferred if the county had a unique key, but I don't think we would stipulate either way.
Okay, I mean, we can be flexible on that. It's just that the biggest implication is on the counties themselves.
I agree, yeah.
For that. Okay. Mesa County currently employs voter-activated functionality whereby the voter is issued a single-use PEB at check-in and they approach the Ivotronic and activate the machine without poll worker assistance. Will they be required to have the PEB, the voter PEB, locked into the Ivotronic well during a voting session?
I think we would...
If we were to continue allowing for a voter-activated method.
Right, right. Understood. I think the ideal answer would be yes, but I'd want to defer to the counties a little bit because that would require a double instance of the judge appearing. You know, when the voter is done, there could be some confusion there about raising their hand or getting obnoxious beeps if the judge can't come running right over at that instance. So there would have to be some allowance for how to, the voter to walk away after they've cast their ballot. So maybe the answer is no, but I mean, if we could call on the counties to kind of talk about the process and what the flow goes like, that'd probably help us.
Do you want us to get into that now?
Sure.
I'll just kind of talk through.
And Amy, just identify yourself.
Sorry, Amy Storm, Chief Deputy, Mesa County. I'll kind of talk through what our process looks like, and then you can let us know what your concern is, and we can help talk through, you know, a recommendation for getting past this. Really, when a voter comes to early voting or to a vote center. When we have the voter-activated PEBs, their eligibility is verified. Their individual PEB is burned from a supervisor unit by the same poll worker that determines their eligibility for their specific ballot style, precinct, whatever. They are handed the PEB that was activated for their particular ballot style, and they're actually ushered through a cattle line, if you will, that is roped off. So we have poll workers at the beginning of the line, poll workers at the end of the line, as a booth becomes available, the voter is is directed with their PEB in their hand to a voting booth. When we set up our locations, we set them up so that each of the units is visually within visual perspective of the judge that's managing that area, and the voter is then given instruction to put the PEB into the PEB well, and that if they have questions on how to get started with the process or whatever, that there are people available in the area to assist them, and that when they're finished, to hit the cast ballot button, remove the PEB, and return it to that individual. So I'm not sure how feasible it is for us to have a lockdown for that PEB, since each voter has one in their hand. You know, each of those PEBs is on a manifest with serial number when it's delivered to the location. Those PEBs are verified then at the back end that those are the PEBs that are returned from that particular location. We could certainly go through at the end when we download the audit data to ensure that only the PEBs that were issued to the location were actually used at the location, because all of that information is captured on the audit log.
Okay. Thank you.
That's yours.
That's mine.
I think you know, it's obvious that the layer of security is required to mitigate the concerns that you've raised. It's obviously providing a solution for a poll worker or a voter-activated system, is represents a far more complex solution, and it has more implications than the fact that it makes it more difficult to be able to fully utilize the design of the case, the Ivotronic in the case, because if we were to implement a solution as the state had proposed, then the units would not be able to be shipped in the polling booth, or the lids won't close properly, or that would require the poll workers then to take another step at the site to install some level of device. So it does become a little more complex and a more cumbersome solution.
I agree that there is an extra step. I disagree that the doors do close because that plastic cover comes off. You know, we just envision that would be something that the judges would have in their supply bag, and as they're running their zero reports, they just simply pop it in place. It's not a cumbersome process to pop those the two that we have specified. You know, it's not very cumbersome to just slip that in and lock it.
It's another step, you know, and another piece of equipment to manage, you know, for the counties as well as the poll workers. Okay. So in this document that I have in front of you, an alternative method to the state's proposal has been designed is viewed to be less cumbersome and allows the unit to be able to be shipped to the polling site fully intact, so that there's no additional effort or work or logistics with any other components that would need to be managed. What we've done is, and you can see there's several pictures here, and I've actually brought a prototype that I can pass around, but what we've done is actually create a lockable shield that would go over the PEB well and actually wrap around the Ivotronic, and it would prevent the introduction of any magnetic interference with the system entirely, and I'll pass that around to you right now.
Thank you.
essentially, it's a cover that is will lock the PEB well from access of any device. So it would be installed on the machine. When a poll worker would approach the unit, they would unlock it, insert the PEB, activate the voting session, and the cover would be put back in place and locked.
And what are the advantages over the cage? I'm assuming, maybe I'm asking to state the obvious.
It stays with the unit itself. It's fully integrated with the unit. The form fit function is with the booth is satisfied so that the booth can fully close and be shipped with that in place.
Any comments about that?
Yes, I would like.
This is Michael Chadwell. I'm a member of the test board. When we went down this path, I had actually originally envisioned something along this line and even tested some designs similar to this. I couldn't quite fabricate it to this degree. But a couple of problems that I ran into, and that's why I'm curious about this, is that it was material dependent. It was going to require a low ferrite type metal shielding. In addition to that, what we discovered is that there's an X and a Y and a Z influence about this. So these boxes that we came up with, they kept getting increasingly larger to try to keep the magnet outside of that three-dimensional perimeter. So my curiosity about this, depending on the material type, if it's not a low ferrite type metal, then it doesn't provide the Z dimension that's required to prevent the influence of the magnet.
That prototype there has been engineered and tested with magnets of all varying sizes, and there has been no influence of any magnetic interference with the systems at all. It actually overlaps the PEB well and then wraps down around the side, and it provides that particular prototype, and I'm not sure exactly what the material is, but we feel confident we'll satisfy the concern that has been raised by the board.
Can we use that to test?
Yeah, that was going to be my suggestion. I don't think it would take very long to, we could probably know this afternoon, you know, if this would work or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would that be okay?
Sure. Yeah. And that, the implication of that is that we would need to go into production with those units. There is a lead time for those. It's approximately an 8-week lead time at this point. The design would be finalized, and then it'd probably be 6 to 8 weeks, but more than likely an 8-week would be the safest to plan for lead time for those. And then if it doesn't change from its current configuration, there is a cost impact of $60 each for each device.
Okay. So that would cost $60 per device for the counties?
Yes, there's engineering and tooling and manufacturing costs for those that would need to be included in that.
So the extra step for the judges might not be that bad. I think that was a $6 or $8 solution.
It'd still be engineering and tooling and product. It might be less. I don't know.
Sure.
We didn't investigate that.
Okay.
You know, I think what we've tried to do is satisfy the requirement. So I'm sure there's a multitude of design ideas and concepts, but we really tried to factor in all the factors and really keeping in mind the implication and impact to the counties as well as the poll workers.
Okay. Any other questions about that? No. Okay, so we'll take a look at that hopefully this afternoon. Do a little bit of testing. Anything else, Mr. Pearson?
That's it from my viewpoint.
Okay,
thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Liss, I think, is next.
Morning. My name is Josh Liss, Deputy of Elections for Jefferson County. I want to start by thanking the Secretary of State's office, the testing board, and Deputy Secretary Hobbs for allowing us to not only participate here today, but also to help participate in the completion of the multiple-page ballot testing. I thought it went very well last week, and I appreciate that opportunity. And my goal here today will be more, as Mr. Pearson presented, in trying to present alternatives to some of the conditions, not getting into arguing the testing process or anything. I think we've been through enough of that so far. But what Jefferson and Mesa County's goals and ESNS's goals have been, I think, from the beginning, is to try to offer alternative solutions. You know, I think the testing board came up with conditions and recommendations, and I think the counties and the vendors also have some expertise and might be able to come up with alternatives that satisfy everybody's needs in meeting security and also meeting the unique demands of each county. We will be submitting written comments by Monday, but I was just going to briefly go over some of the key points with some of the conditions that we're going to discuss later in our written testimony. So first I'd like to discuss condition 1C for the conditions for the Unity software. The condition essentially requires a reload of the Unity database after the close of polls on election night. And the goal, as I gather, is to ensure file integrity on the reporting system. We feel that loading a new database on the system does not necessarily accomplish that goal, and there might be some alternatives that we might be able to use to both ensure system integrity and tracking of any interaction with the database. And we'll go into a lot more detail in the written testimony, but basically the alternative solution would consist of a process where the county could strictly monitor all the files involved in tabulation and reporting, as well as operating system files, to ensure that none are modified from a known trusted build, which we understand is going to be installed on the system. We could accomplish this goal by acquiring one of several third-party, commercially available, or open-source CRC file fingerprinting and file monitoring software applications. The applications give a unique number of fingerprint for each file and then monitor the fingerprint for the slightest change in order to detect and report tampering with any critical piece of the system. We believe that alternative would provide or would accomplish the goal of system integrity. It also preserves all the audit data and ensures that the system used in the election is the same one that was tested in pre-election testing. So we will give some more detail on that in our written testimony, but I think there are some file monitoring systems that we could use rather than reloading a new database on election night. Another problem that brings up is we are also counting ballots prior to election day. If we're loading a new database after the polls close on election night, are we then forced to combine results from two separate databases or delete the original database and start all over again from scratch with our early voting and mail-in ballot results? So those are some of the questions that brought up. Steve, like to add something?
Hi, this is Steve Pearson again. I'd just like to add another comment about this. I think it's important everybody understands that, you know, as the results are accumulated on election night, those are unofficial results, and the final election results are really not final until they're validated through a canvas process. So to go through, we can replicate and triplicate systems, but you got to understand that all the media, I mean, all the results from each of the devices, all the results tapes, all of those things will be validated in the canvas process before they would become official results. So all of these steps here, this would be measures to try to further protect the unofficial results that are already being run in a secure environment. I mean, so just keep that in, we want you to keep that in mind, if you will, when you make your final determination.
Thank you.
I'd like to add to that before I move on to the next one, too, that keep in mind also that the Unity software and all the counting equipment, as we all know, is operating in a physically secure environment. Because of Rule 43, we have continuous video monitoring systems. We have, secure access to the counting room itself. We have logs to tell who is going in and out of those counting rooms. And everyone in the counting rooms are subject to and given CBI background checks. So we do have, it's kind of a two-prong approach in response to the Conroy-Dennis lawsuit. We not only have a new certification process with new certification rules, but we also got a very important rule out of that with Rule 43 that helps to dictate our security procedures and processes and the physical security, and I don't think those things should be ignored, too. Next, I was just going to talk briefly about...
Can I ask you a question before you go on? If this was modified so that the process didn't take place on election night but was included as part of the canvas, would that be an okay change?
How would you envision the transferring of data? If we're starting with one database and we're talking about, pre-election testing and then through election day, how would the new database be loaded, or what purpose would it serve?
Well, there are conditions, and this is one in particular that is in combination with other steps for other devices that have deficiencies. And this kind of sets up the stage for some of those other events to take place. And I'm not saying that this is the only way to go. I'm just trying to make it workable. And it sounded like doing it on election night was impossible or just so problematic and troublesome. And I understand, election night's kind of crazy. If it took place as part of the canvas to set up for those other events, would that be more helpful or no?
One less thing on election night is probably more helpful than anything. But one of the concerns with the idea of completely replacing a database with a new database, two concerns actually. One, you're using a database that wasn't part of the pre-election testing, and in some ways possibly eliminating audit information when loading a new database. Second is that with a new database, if the system somehow becomes corrupted and you're loading a clean database into it, it's not cleaning up the system. It's adding a clean database into a corrupted system.
Oh, yeah.
So, one of our suggestions would be that rather than swapping databases, we could actually monitor all the files within the operating system. Then if there is some bad event, we can detect that and troubleshoot it right away.
Yeah, I'm not discrediting your alternative.
Right.
I'm just trying to... if there could be a possibility for two or three alternatives listed here, but if this one is so onerous that it wouldn't even be considered, there could be other users of the system that may not want to do that route. They may need another route. I'm just trying to provide some flexibility.
Sure.
Trying to look at how to do both. But we'll certainly consider your option there.
Okay, great. Thank you. Anything else on that particular? Okay. Next is... Condition 3D regarding the audit trail information. I think we have several alternatives here. I mean, this condition proposes that we would do a post-election audit on a predetermined number of ballots based on the number of ballots cast in the election and the closeness of the race It's that the chart with the difference. If the difference between the two candidates is a certain percentage, then
for this, you're talking about the central count M650 condition 3.
Yes. Yes.
B.
Yes.
Okay. Got it.
Frankly, this one is a little bit scary. Only that, well, for several reasons, but if we're looking at worst case scenario, which I think election professionals are trained to consider worst case scenario, using our 2004 presidential election results as a baseline in Jefferson County, this formula could conceivably require us to hand count after the election up to 32,400 ballots, which by itself is a little bit troublesome. With current statutory deadlines, this would be required to be done within a span of 17 days after the election. I'll say that's a bit of a tall order. Now, that's as I said, the worst case scenario if the percentage of the difference between the top two candidates and the closest race is within that frame, but we have to have a look at what kind of impact this could have. There are some flaws, and I should say, you know, I think there are some tweaking that can be done, but there are some things that bring up questions. One, it's the sample size is the difference in votes between the hand count increases as the difference between the top two candidates decreases. So I think we need to be a bit mindful of the perception that only the close races are important, if only the close races trigger this kind of audit. I mean, with our current requirements and statute and rules, we have more of a random sampling for our audit. Randomly determined, the races are randomly determined by the Secretary of State's office. It's not just the closest races that count. It also doesn't consider ballot issue elections, and that also, I think, gives a bit of an impression that issue elections are not as important as candidate elections. So, not that I'm arguing to expand the condition, but I'm just bringing it up because I think there's other things we should consider. And it doesn't address, what if you have a race with fewer than 10,000 ballots cast? What kind of recount under this condition is required, if any? Let's see. I would argue, and I think we will argue, or present in our written testimony, that currently Colorado post-election audit statutes are among the most stringent in the country. There's one state, Connecticut, I think it is, who has a higher percentage or tested a higher percentage for their post-election audits. But our audits are pretty strong as you compare them to the rest of the states in the country. And if I'm correct, they were just put into law last year, so they haven't even been tested in a full primary and general election. The first time we got to actually test the threshold of our current audit requirements was in 2007 in a ballot issue election that was, frankly, a small election in terms of the number of issues on the ballot and in terms of turnout. So the first suggestion would be to let us actually test our current audit requirements as they are in statute and in rule. The second consideration I would mention is that we know right now, I know we can't plan conditions on potential legislation, but we do know that there's a pretty good possibility we're going to be talking about audits here in the next month or so, both for statewide required audits. So perhaps this condition should be stayed until that discussion is had, or until we're able to have a discussion amongst counties, Secretary of State, interested parties on what the state of Colorado audit should look like. And we will, again, suggest written alternatives. The final point I would make in this one, and I'd be happy to answer whatever questions I can, is throughout the testing, and now that, especially now that the scanners themselves are actually recertified, I don't believe there was any question about the accuracy of the ballot counting. So if, to me, if there's no question about the scanners counting accurately, why do we need additional audits to prove that the scanners count accurately? I mean, if that was never an issue or never a question, then maybe we have the right audits in place. Questions?
Well, John, why don't you comment? I think they would be helpful.
Okay. A few points. The reason why the count increases as the outcome of the election gets closer is that it takes fewer amount of votes to change the outcome. So to identify fewer number of votes, you need to kind of throw a larger net out there to try to find those. So as you need a larger number of votes, the evidence of that would appear in a smaller sampling. So it's not that we're just picking on races that are close. There's, you know, some statistical value there. But I do think, you know, ultimately the testing board is not necessarily hung up on the numbers. You know, we had to throw some kind of model out there.
Right.
So, you know, this is kind of where we started. The really important parts is that, well, first off, that there is some increase to the audit, that we're looking for some higher levels. The second thing is that this is not to be a rerun of ballots. They're wanting to capture the data from election night. Current law allows for a rerun of the ballots. And then the third thing would be to audit all the way back to the software. And this is kind of the big point, because you're right, it's not an accuracy issue. We're dealing with a security and an audit issue. So all those deficiencies we're trying to roll into this process, where, you know, determining the outcome is a critical point for the secretary, but we have all these security deficiencies, we have a lot of audit deficiencies identified. So if you can verify that the outcome hasn't changed through an audit process where you trace back the ballots to the machine, to the Unity software, and ensure that nothing malicious has taken place because you're verifying these totals all along the way, that would address a lot of the concerns. That's kind of where we're coming from. But I think we're open to change in the numbers. You know, we're hoping that some of these other goals are met through the process, though.
Okay. Can I ask, is this condition, is this intended to be in place of or in addition to current state audit requirements?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's kind of the other spot that we're kind of stuck up against, because we do have that Rule 11 requirement, and I think this might have been intended to supersede that, but it doesn't seem like we have the authority to go below any requirement. I think the law allows for a minimum number of ballots, so, you know, this might have to be tweaked to say no less than the currently allowed number by law or something like that. But you're right, I mean, the pending legislation sure could dictate, you know, the outcome of this, and this whole thing might be a moot point.
Well, and I think, you know, whatever the condition ends up being is going to have to work in concert, not only with pending legislation, but also with Rule 11, and have some guidance on whether the condition, as you mentioned, supersedes the rule, or we have to do both, or what the final post-election days look like.
I agree.
Amy?
Amy Storm, Chief Deputy, Mesa County. I have a question. In listening to what you were saying about the auditing back to the software, if we were to batch ballots from the point that they are prepared for tabulation, if we were to batch those ballots, run a result from the 650, for instance, with that batch, leave that paper result with the batch, create a zip disk for that batch that could then be audited to Unity ERM, and have the Canvas board essentially randomly select a batch to audit. Would that help satisfy your concern?
Yeah, I think that's getting to the you know this kind of process that we're trying to set up, that kind of detail, where I would assume once you upload that zip disk into Unity that you would then print a report that represents just the data on that zip disk. Or maybe you would have two reports that shows the delta between zip disk 1 and zip disk 2, right? That's really what we're talking about, yeah.
Because those are actually processes that we have in place.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, if that's the kind of road you're going down, we certainly already do have those checks and balances in place and could further them to the Canvas board and allow the Canvas board to then select randomly a batch that could be audited rather than the Secretary of State's random audit selection, for instance.
I agree, and I think there is some language in here that talks about that kind of process as well.
Anything else on this one?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Josh.
I'll turn it back over to Amy.
And I didn't know you were done, Josh. Do I need to identify myself again?
No. Amy.
They can identify the laugh, right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to discuss some of the conditions. We really do appreciate it, and we do appreciate having the opportunity to be a part of the testing. That was it was beneficial, and it went very well. Like Josh, I'm just going to touch on a couple of specific conditions and a couple of specific points that we will further address in written testimony. I think we're probably going to develop a single document rather than multiple documents for submission, because in most cases I think we are in agreement as to options for conditions. With the precinct scanner, the M100, condition 2 that talks about the UPS battery backups, that's a very costly solution, and in our opinion, that the test was not necessarily a real world test. When you looked at the log for that test, there were override functionalities that happened approximately every 4 seconds, utilizing battery power for that machine. In a real-world scenario, a ballot is not likely going to be cast every 4 seconds, and most of those ballots will not require an override functionality on an M100. Counties could certainly put in place within their security procedures to have generators for locations that would lose power to be available to be dispatched within a time frame, rather than requiring us to have expensive UPSs on site at each one of the locations. Because it's reasonably unlikely that we are going to have a major power outage throughout an entire county that would require more than a couple of generators being dispatched within a given time frame. I'm not saying that it couldn't happen, but the likelihood that we would need more than a couple of generators within a county over more than a couple of hours is unlikely.
John, did you have a comment?
Can I just ask a question?
Sure.
If we change that title, it currently says external battery backup UPS devices required. If we just left it at external battery backup and left it generic, because the text of the requirement does say the counties shall purchase and use an external power supply. That kind of makes it flexible to UPSs, generators, car batteries.
That would be helpful.
Okay.
Can I have one? I just
This is Steve Pearson, and I'd just like to add a point on this. The M100 in the design with the ballot box, that in the event that it would lose power, you know, after a 2 hour and 57 minute or however long it before it in continuous use before we lost power, it has a secure ballot box so that people can you can continue voting. You would never ever hold up the voting until the power was restored. So they would open up, the poll worker would then open up a secure flap on the ballot box. They would, all those ballots would be inserted, you know, into that secure slot until such time power was restored. So I think there's a couple factors you just need to take into consideration. Machines would never be in continuous use like they were tested, you know, just feeding ballots continuously until the system died. And then secondly, there always is another alternative for ballots, for voters voting to proceed, the ballots to be captured, and then to be run at a later time when power was restored. So, thanks.
Thanks, Steve. While we're on battery backups, can we jump to condition one on the DREs? Because it also requires a similar UPS backup, and I have to find it a little bit ironic that the system failed the test because it was 7 minutes short of the 3 hours that with continuous voting. So I find that one a little bit ironic. Would it be possible for us to change that language similarly, John?
Yes. Oh, sure. Yes.
Okay. Because that would be very helpful if, you know, we had battery backup available within the county, not necessarily for the unit.
Right. And maybe I will show a card here by throwing this out there. But I did just this morning do some research on the section for performance, Chad Closures, and. From our perspective, we're pretty, you know, the testing board is pretty absolute. So 3 hours, it's 3 hours. You got 2 hours and 53 minutes. But most likely, I will propose to the secretary to view this section as you can. At the heading of the section, it does say that the systems will be substantially compliant to these requirements.
So there
could be some changes that come by that kind of recommendation.
That would be wonderful.
I hope I didn't reveal too much, though.
That's okay. Too late. Cat's out of the bag.
I feel so exposed.
I'm going to back up the recording here just a little bit.
back on the M100, condition 5B requires a manual hand count of the ballots be verified against the ballots cast on each piece of equipment. When we used the M100s, which we may actually end up doing again, depending on the outcome of Senate Bill 189, we actually utilized a statement of ballot that went through that, a very similar process, although we felt it was a superior process because not only did we validate the number of ballots that were tabulated on the M100 to the ballots that were in the ballot box, but also the ballots cast, the number of voters that were at the location through a statement of ballot. And we'll detail that in our written testimony. But those are already procedures that are in place, and I don't know that we necessarily have to have a manual hand count of the ballots to verify that component. With the utilization of a statement of ballot, because we do have ballot inventory that is validated against ballots that are cast on the machine. On to the Ivotronic, condition 6A, that is requiring yet another seal. If the connection between the RTL printer, if that connection is disconnected from the voting the machine pauses and sounds an alarm. I don't know that it is really necessary to place a seal over that. You know, we have those connections tightly on there. There is visual inspection by the judges at the location of those machines, and they're monitored nearly continuously during the hours of voting. When they are not, when we're not in the hours of voting, the machines are sealed with the cases from the outside. I'm not sure what we're trying to prevent in putting yet an eighth seal on the Ivotronic at the RTAL printer port. Well, I realize it. Once, I mean, if it's disconnected, you can't vote on the unit. If the machine is enabled for the RTAL printer, you can't actually vote on the unit unless it's plugged in.
John, thank you. The you mentioned that you have the connection tightly attached.
Mm-hmm.
How do you mean? Can you describe that?
Well, you know, the thumb screws that actually attach the connector.
Yeah. Okay. That could be part of our problem. The unit that we have for testing, probably all the units that we have, do not have thumb screws or other screw devices to attach that.
All of ours have thumb screws on them.
Well, that could be something to consider. The problem with the unit is not that you could vote on the DRE. It's that you could take that VPAT connection and connect it to another device because it's just a 9-pin serial connection, so you could put data onto there that shouldn't be there. So if you could disconnect that in between voting.
And get the alarm to not sound while someone is watching.
In theory, yes. But that's kind of the point. But, I mean, if you have thumb screws on there, I mean, that's, you know, we just don't have that in our test.
Yes, all of ours have thumb screws on them.
The machines.
All of our 9-pin connectors have thumb screws.
Okay.
On to condition 8B and C. You know, I'm not sure where we need to go with the voter activated piece of our Ivotronics, other than, you know, we already do have procedures in place that monitor which PEBs are allocated to which locations. The voters are monitored. We could put up additional signage, and we could, after the fact, inspect the audit and event logs for a malicious occurrence. He had to say something.
Josh Liss again from Jefferson County. I was just going to talk a little bit about the backup battery conditions, both for the M100 and for the Ivo. We learned a lot of things over the last year. Some I'm sure we didn't want to learn, but we learned a lot of things over the past year, and one of the things we learned is that our backup batteries run for 2 hours and 53 minutes with continuous use. I think for that measurable, we thank the board so that we know. Because with our existing processes, Jefferson County currently, and I don't want to speak for Mesa, but I think they do the same, similar setup, we have roving troubleshooters throughout the county on election day and during early voting. Those troubleshooters have sections of the county that they're assigned to and certain precincts they're assigned to, so they have their own specific area, and they are supplied with backup ballots, backup machines, backup batteries, toolboxes, walkie-talkies, anything they could possibly need to go and assist on-site at polling places. So now that we know if a polling place were to have a power failure, we know the clock is ticking and we essentially have 2 hours and 53 minutes, and that's with continuous use. So regular use is probably a little less, or a little more time, I should say. So some of our current procedures address that emergency power outage situation, and you know, one way we would take care of that or handle that is to dispatch our troubleshooters, get them out there, have them ready with backup batteries so that we could keep voting and voting would not be interrupted, and if so, for a small period of time. I think, you know, federal voluntary voting system guidelines, I believe the requirement for battery power is 2 hours. Correct me if I'm wrong, John. I think among the things that we've learned over this past year is that in being forced in the situation that the Secretary of State's office was, a lot of pressure and a lot of little time to draft what I think in large part is a good, strong rule. It's stronger than what we had in the past for voting system certification. But I think we've been able to identify, and I'm sure the testing board can speak better than anyone on what some of the pitfalls or some of the things that are a part of that rule could be changed. So I would just suggest that regarding this specific condition or this specific issue identified by the testing board, perhaps this is a rule making change that could be in concert with the current VBSG. But I think we have a lot of opportunities, and this is certainly not one of them, but a lot of opportunities between now and August for potentially making Rule 45 in those specific areas a little more workable for everybody. So that's all I would suggest.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay, Mr. Pearson.
Just some closing remarks. This is Steve Pearson with the SNS. We thank you for this opportunity again. I'll echo what our partners in Mesa and Jefferson County. And I don't know if this is any assurance to the Secretary of State and the testing board, but this same system that you are considering and you have conditionally certified, which we are thankful for, is the same system that is running in these 29 states. And we've just had a tremendous primary season thus far. Probably one of the most notable ones was the Ohio election this week. It was this system. It was the Cuyahoga thing was in the spotlight, and the system performed flawlessly, and we got accolades from the county saying it's one of the best elections they've ever run. So those are just small assurances. It's also been recently approved by the state of Texas, and I've been verbally told by the state of California that they and we expect to get it any day, the certification on the same system as well. So just thought I'd pass that on.
Same hardware and software version?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Virtually the same. There might be a variation here or there, but virtually exactly the same. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify, and I think those present are finished. So we'll conclude. I would like to thank everybody for being here, and I know you've got lots of things on your plate, and appreciate you taking the time and providing the information, and it will be helpful, I think, to get the written materials as well. We really appreciate you doing that. So with that, we'll adjourn the hearing. It's 11:20 a.m. Thank you very much.